This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 22, 2002. I'm Protheb Chatterjee, filling in for Deepa Fernandez. The White House is backing off a proposal to use the United States military for a stronger domestic policing role. As WorldCom filed for the largest bankruptcy in United States history, laid-off workers and shareholders say that they do not trust the company management's promise to put the company back on its feet. And in Philadelphia, the Green Party ended their first national midterm convention this weekend. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After months of stalling, President Bush has decided to withhold funds authorized by Congress for United Nations family planning programs. Susan Wood has more from the UN.
The Associated Press reports the Bush administration will announce as early as Tuesday it will not pay $34 million to the UN Population Fund, which provides services from contraception to labor and delivery care to women in 142 countries. The foreign aid bill containing the funds has already been signed into law, but UNFPA's money has been frozen since January following allegations by abortion foes that the agency condones forced abortion and sterilization in China. According to Terry Bartlett, Vice President for Public Policy for the nonprofit Population Action International,
the reason behind this is to keep the anti-abortion forces in America happy.
UNFPA says it does not fund abortions. Bartlett says due to legislative restrictions, no U.S. money has gone to UNFPA's program in China in 8 years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
And the Environmental Protection Agency has changed their mind and will pay to clean up 11 toxic waste sites across the country. Scott Gurian reports from Bloomfield, New Jersey.
While stating that it will now provide close to $30 million to clean up 11 contaminated sites as part of the Superfund program, the EPA will only grant 4 of them the full amounts its regional offices had recommended, and 22 more sites will get nothing. In New Jersey, which contains roughly 10% of all Superfunds nationwide, the Combe Fills South Landfill in Chester Township has been one of the sites fortunate to be granted cleanup funds. Among the sites that remain unfunded are the abandoned Chemical Insecticide Corporation in Edison, which manufactured Agent Orange until the company went out of business in the early 1970s. In response, EPA officials have said that more sites may receive additional financing this summer, but many more will not. In New Jersey, this is Scott Gurian for Free Speech Radio News.
The christened nuclear-free flotilla of the environmental group Greenpeace face two boats off the coast of Australia today, trying to stop a shipment of almost 500 pounds of plutonium en route to the United Kingdom. Patrick Beckett has more.
Two protesters leapt into the sea in front of the ships transporting the nuclear fuel. Australian parliamentarian Ian Cohen and Stuart Lennox of Tasmania jumped into the water just 450 yards in front of one of the vessels while holding a nuclear-free Pacific banner. Cohen, along with Australian Democrats and Greens, believe the shipment poses a risk to the Australian mainland, but the Australian government has said it does not object to the shipment. The New Zealand government, however, has made its opposition clear and has ordered its air force to track the passage of the vessels. The protest took place in international waters in the Tasmanian Sea as the ships prepare to pass south of Australia before crossing the Indian Ocean. Greenpeace spokesperson Ian McSevney explains that while the upcoming Cape of Good Hope is known as a dangerous passage for ships, the only other option was politically impossible.
Well, it's got to go along the Solemn Seas now, along towards Cape of Good Hope, yes, South Africa, and then it's got to come all the way up. We think that the other route would have taken it through the Panama Canal, which is the route that the ships went out on. But there's a lot of lobbying on because I think the countries around the Panama Canal aren't happy about nuclear shipments in general going through there.
I'm Patrick Beckett for Free Speech Radio News.
A large fire and the continued occupation of 4 Chevron pumping stations by women who are demanding jobs and community development in the Niger Delta have stopped the majority of Chevron Texaco's Nigerian oil production. Chevron's oil output suffered another blow when lightning set fire to a major offshore oil terminal, leading credence to community concerns that the U.S. company's operation pollutes their environment. Chevron's Nigerian spokesperson said that the fire was contained without hurting the local communities. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved a bill that seeks to reduce false convictions in death penalty cases. Jay Tamboli has more from D.C.
The Innocence Protection Act's main components encourage states to take steps to preserve DNA evidence, provide better access to DNA evidence for both prosecutors and defendants, and provide well-qualified counsel for defendants in the death penalty cases. With Congress's August recess looming, and Homeland Security being the likely area of concentration until then, the Innocence Protection Act is unlikely to be passed this year. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jay Tamboli.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In December, Enron filed for Chapter 11 protection, setting the record for the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Now, as the recent wave of corporate scandals continues, WorldCom filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, setting a new all-time high of $107 billion in assets sunk into bankruptcy. While the company issues hopeful statements and says it will be back on its feet in a year, as Nell Geiser reports, laid-off workers and disenchanted shareholders are not so trusting.
WorldCom laid off 17,000 workers last month as its debts piled up and allegations of fraud and scandal mounted. In a political environment suddenly filled with strong statements about the need for corporate accountability and bankruptcy reform, the company is treading carefully and says it will look out for its workers and investors. Both industry consultants and disenchanted workers don't buy WorldCom's assurances of future stability.
We won't be compensated for any of the money or investment that we lost.
Leanne Armstrong was a sales manager with WorldCom in Arizona until the company laid her off in May.
These guys always can find a loophole and a way around things, and I think it's going to be difficult for them to really police this, you know, any better. There's always going to be some way around it, it just seems. If they have money, they're going to be able to buy their way out of whatever the situation, and it's all of us little guys that end up paying the biggest price.
WorldCom CEO John Sidgemore filed for bankruptcy shortly before 9 p.m. last night. Sidgemore has served as chief executive for only a few months, taking over the company after information about massive loans to former CEO Bernard Ebbers went public. On July 1st, the company filed a revised version of its financial statements for the first quarter, which included $3.8 billion in improperly accounted for expenses. In the wake of these revelations, WorldCom fired its chief financial officer, and the financial controller resigned from the board of directors. The telecom giant is assuring consumers and industry watchdogs that its services will not be affected. The company is the second largest provider of long distance through its ownership of MCI and the largest internet services provider in the United States. But Regina Costa with the Utilities Reform Network based in San Francisco says even though MCI phone service won't shut down, consumers should be ready for big changes in the telecommunications industry.
The telecommunications sector is a mess. There's no question about that. And a lot of that's due to the fact that Wall Street analysts were just jumping on this internet bandwagon left and right and didn't stop to try to actually understand the nature of the industry and whether a lot of business practices made sense. MCI, the long-distance company, has been around for a long time. WorldCom, the conglomerate, has been like a mini volcano that's just been building and building and building with a series of eruptions.
After filing bankruptcy papers, CEO Sidgemore said the company does not have any plans to lay off more of its 60,000 employees. He says the company plans to continue operations while implementing a restructuring plan over the next year. For the non-union workforce of WorldCom, like that of Enron, the future doesn't look bright. The AFL-CIO is looking to file a claim on behalf of WorldCom workers who did not receive adequate severance pay.
WorldCom was a viciously anti-union company.
Damon Silvers, general counsel for the AFL-CIO.
You know, did everything it could to make sure that its workers did not have an independent voice on the job. And as a result, the workers had no contractual protections and no defined benefit pension plan and have ended up being completely defenseless in this situation now. In the coming months, we're going to be going to the street and holding the people accountable both in corporate America and in our government who are responsible for the terrible things that have happened to working people in the last year.
Unlike Enron, WorldCom has significant tangible assets that will continue to generate revenue. But creditors such as Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and GE Capital are waiting for repayment of old loans, even as WorldCom confirmed a $2 billion refinancing loan last night. The company faces $41 billion in overall debt and workers like Leanne Armstrong don't trust their promises that no more employees will suffer the consequences of corporate fraud.
I would be surprised. I think that they're doing that to buy time, to keep the people there that are still there working and committed to staying and doing what they can to help the company get whatever they can get at this point.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser.
The White House is already backing off a proposal to bring the U.S. military into a stronger domestic policing role. General Ralph Eberhardt of the Northern Command said this weekend he'd favor changes to a 124-year-old law forbidding the military from patrolling the streets of the United States. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
The president's Homeland Security Plan calls on Congress to review the Posse Comitatus law passed in 1878.
The U.S. military was assigned by act of Congress in 1867 to physically monitor activities in the South. And it created a controversy that was resolved by the passage of legislation barring the military from any law enforcement purpose within the United States.
Marquette University history professor Theo Harris says after the Civil War, soldiers, by their presence in the South, started interfering in political life. They had been used to put down labor unrest in the South, and Democrats said soldiers used physical intimidation to ensure the election of Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. After that, Posse Comitatus barred the military from domestic policing, which has largely kept soldiers off of America's streets, but not out of politics altogether, according to Professor Harris.
During the World War I and the interwar period, the military was involved in domestic surveillance activities. And then during the 1960s, when you had the emergence of a militant anti-Vietnam War and militant civil rights movement, the military became involved in monitoring domestic activities and domestic activists.
Posse Comitatus has been stretched for the sake of the war on drugs, too. A 1981 defense bill allowed the military to loan equipment and facilities to civilian law enforcement. A 1989 bill allowed military personnel to work as narcotics police in the U.S. A 1991 act authorized the military to go on armed anti-drug reconnaissance missions. The White House proposal to reevaluate Posse Comitatus makes no specific recommendations as to how the military might be used to police America. But retired Army Colonel Dan Smith, now with the Center for Defense Information, says the Bush administration is overreacting.
You have to protect the American people from external attack, yes. You want to protect the 50 states from unwarranted acts by humans that are inside the country, yes. But you also have a responsibility to protect civil liberties. And this is where the Homeland Security Agency, the new department that's being proposed, and Northern Command start running into problems.
The conservative Cato Institute says a bigger problem is that while police are trained to evaluate individual conflict situations and to diffuse tensions, soldiers are trained to shoot to kill. Cato's Gene Healy says that's reason enough to keep soldiers off the streets.
That's a road we don't want to go down. I don't think we want to become a country like Northern Ireland or Colombia or Indonesia, where the distinction between the police and the military breaks down, and it's the citizens become accustomed to seeing armed soldiers on the streets as a part of everyday life. I don't think it would be at all healthy for our political culture, and I think it would lead to significant collateral damage and civilian death.
Healy fears if the Posse Comitatus law is further weakened, there could be more fatalities, like that of Ezequiel Hernandez, a high school kid who was shot dead by Marines on a drug recon mission in 1997. Healy notes a connection to the 1993 Waco Branch Davidian case, too. Alleging the Waco compound contained a drug lab, federal authorities were supplied with military equipment. Army Delta Force advisors helped strategize for the siege, in which almost 100 civilians and four federal agents died. Two powerful Democrats in the Senate are going along with the White House plan to reevaluate the law that keeps the military out of domestic policing. Armed Services Committee Chairman Carl Levin said he'd consider supporting changes to the law as long as soldiers don't get to arrest anybody. Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Joseph Biden says he favors the military having arrest powers in the U.S. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is set to release a report that could significantly narrow the funds available for U.S.-sponsored fumigations in Colombia. If the EPA finds the pesticides sprayed by the government are toxic to farmers and the environment, Congress has said that it will cut all funding for the controversial spraying. In the Cimitarra River Valley, located in mid-northern Colombia, an organized campesino association of more than 10,000 subsistence farmers from 124 communities struggle to defend their lives. Members tell how Plan Colombia affects their life and death in the region. Reporter Nicole Carson traveled to the Cimitarra River Valley. She files this report.
In a small jungle village along the Cimitarra River, a local campesino plants green sprouts of coca on a steep slope. During his lunch break, Alvaro Manzana finds shade under a bush and says that when his community was fumigated twice last year, it killed more food crops like yuca and banana than cocoa fields. Manzana says the zone that was fumigated was finished off. He is a member of the Cimitarra River Valley Campesino Association, and the aerial fumigations are part of Plan Colombia. Manzana says villagers in his community suffered skin rashes as a result of the fumigations. The herbicide mixture being used is manufactured by the Monsanto Corporation, maker of Agent Orange. The unknown health and environmental risks caused by the spraying have sparked a large debate in Congress, which in January called for a six-month moratorium on fumigations in Colombia until the Environmental Protection Agency certifies the safety of the spraying. What does seem clear is that despite fumigations, coca fields are still plentiful in the Colombian countryside, and Manzana says funds from Plan Colombia allotted to assist the campesinos in alternative development projects are not getting to them. Last May, the anti-narcotics police director in Bogota was scandalously charged with embezzling $2 million of that money.
Through the U.S. Plan, Colombia invests a lot of money into the substitution of crops, but this money has stayed in the hands of politicians. The campesinos have not received any resources, so we have to resort to planting illicit crops, something that the campesino does not like because it generates problems. But there's nothing for subsistence, so we need to do it.
For a long time, campesinos in Cimitarra have wanted to stop cultivating coca. In 1996, the association constructed a plan to manually eradicate coca from the region and simultaneously stabilize markets for non-illicit and less lucrative crops like sugarcane, yuca, and buffalo cheese. The association has secured funding from the United Nations and World Wildlife Fund for, among others, a collective housing construction project. Gilberto Hernandez, a spokesman for the association, says that the association counted on 250 million pesos, or $25 million, from the Colombian government for the coca eradication plan, which was an agreement signed by President Pastrana in 1998.
The idea was to plant legal crops to replace illicit crops. Three fundamental parts. One, for coca growers in the region to follow the forestry law, which they agreed was the redistribution of lands to produce in fertile areas. Two, titles of their private property. Three, investments and rights to commercialization. But the fumigation came and everything stopped, so there wasn't manual eradication nor a process with alternative projects. The little food security there was put at risk, and the people's health was put at risk.
The government's money to implement the plan never came. 2 years later, in 2000, the government offered them money from Plan Colombia, but after taking a consensus, members of the association refused it.
Aceptar la plata.
We do not want to participate in a plan concealed by the beautiful name of social investment. To accept its resources is to accept the strategic plan, which is Plan Colombia, a plan of war to finish off the communities. The fumigations have several objectives. One, which sounds beautiful from newscasters, is to finish off the narco industries. But the result here is that to fumigate 1 hectare of coca is to fumigate 3 or 4 hectares of agricultural food products and grass for grazing.
The six-month moratorium, designated by Congress's provision, is now over. During the next few days, the EPA will release a report assessing the potential of unreasonable risks and adverse effects to humans and the environment caused by the spraying. If the report deems the spraying too hazardous, Congress will cut the foreign aid that allows the State Department to buy more chemicals for fumigations. Hernandez says the fumigations do not prevent campesinos from harvesting coca, but it does force them to damage the environment.
One thing we can be sure of when they fumigate is that people change their cultivation sites and they go further into the jungle. Another internal displacement with similar characteristics of trying to survive a direct aggression. And so the campesino who has struggled for so long working a parcel of land, trying not to cause harm to the environment, immediately is forced to deforest virgin mountains to plant coca once again.
According to an association spokesperson, there are rumors that the region will be sprayed again in August. But for now, the future of further fumigations in the Cimitarra River Valley and other communities in Colombia lies in the EPA report, due out any day now. Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
California becomes the first state to require auto manufacturers to build cars that will emit the least amount of greenhouse gases as possible. California has the largest auto market in the nation, and environmentalists are hopeful that the state's new law will set a trend for how cars are built throughout the nation. The measure to curb greenhouse gases overcame a multi-million dollar campaign by the auto industry against it. Opponents of the measure say it is an attack on SUVs, minivans, and soccer moms. Mitch Jezrich has this report.
According to the California Environmental Protection Agency, the 1990s was the warmest decade on record. Extreme weather conditions are on the rise, sea levels are rising, and insect-borne diseases such as malaria and yellow fever are expected to increase worldwide. Many scientists believe the rise in temperature is due to the increase of carbon dioxide vehicle emissions, which traps heat into the atmosphere. The United States is the world's largest contributor of such gases. Even President George Bush has acknowledged that global warming is a threat to all, though he refuses to attribute it to cars. But with the San Francisco Bay rising 7 inches in the last 100 years, California needs no more evidence, as Governor Gray Davis signed a bill requiring auto manufacturers to curb the amount of greenhouse gases that cars emit. Russell Long, with the San Francisco-based Blue Water Network, which initiated the measure, says California alone can't reverse global warming, but that it's a good start.
California is only responsible for a few percent of global warming emissions altogether, but you're not going to find any state or any nation, that's responsible for the majority of emissions. You know, the maximum you're going to see is the United States in total being 25%. He could make the same argument about the U.S. and say, well, 25% isn't that big. You know, why should we do anything in the U.S.? And the point is, we all have to do our share. We have to do it both on a national level and on a regional level and on a statewide level and even on a local level.
The measure requires the California Air Resources Board to write regulations on how auto manufacturers will reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. The measure specifically states that auto manufacturers will make cars with the maximum feasible reduction in such emissions starting in 2009. Bill McGavern with the Sierra Club says people could expect more fuel-efficient cars by then.
I don't expect that by 2009 that we're going to have an elimination of carbon dioxide emissions. I do think that we're going to have a range of vehicles that emit lesser amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. So we should have vehicles that go further on a gallon of gas, and with every gallon of gas you burn, you put out a certain amount of carbon dioxide. So the less gas you use, the less carbon dioxide you're emitting.
SUVs have become the new car of choice for most Californians. Just a month ago, the measure was in peril as it stalled in the state assembly due to a media campaign by the auto industry. It claims the measure will raise taxes and lower the speed limits, and that it is an attack on SUVs and minivans. Supporters of the measure say that the Air Resources Board has no authority to do such things, but that didn't assure large vehicle enthusiasts. When the measure passed out of the state legislature, protesters gathered at the Capitol with signs that read, "Don't attack SUVs" and "Stop SUV profiling." Lynn Time was one of those protesters.
electric car. It's a big boondoggle. They're $30,000-$35,000. The consumer is not buying them. They're speaking with their pocketbooks. They're not buying those electric vehicles.
Governor Gray Davis ensures that Californians will still be able to buy as many SUVs as they want, and that car makers will play an integral part in creating the regulations. California state officials, though, have blasted the Bush administration for not dealing with global warming. Environmentalists are hopeful that other states will follow California's lead. There are several northeastern states that are considering similar legislation. But even without it, California's measure could have far-reaching effects, as car manufacturers are unlikely to create a car just for California. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Sacramento.
The Green Party of the United States held their first national midterm convention over the weekend in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This convention was not only the first midterm convention ever by the Greens, but it was the first convention held by the party since it registered with the Federal Election Commission as a national party. From Radio Volta in Philadelphia, Jamie Graham reports.
Corporate greed and how to counter it was even more prominent an issue at the convention than environmental issues, the traditional main focus of the Green Party. The methods to fight the growing power of corporations range from the international level with discussions about dealing with the World Trade Organization and NAFTA, to local and state approaches such as enacting living wage laws and reforming or removing corporate charters. Lisa Shade, running for Maryland's House of Delegates from Tacoma Park, Maryland, explained the power of state governments in granting corporate charters.
Maryland, of course, like every other state, is the issuing body. It's state legislatures that actually formally issue corporate charters. And so not only do we have the power to revoke them, but we also have the power to insert language that could be included in every corporate charter requiring corporations to respect human rights, that you can't maximize profits at the expense of the environment, community well-being, the dignity of workers, et cetera, et cetera.
Other issues at the convention were statehood for the District of Columbia, the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, South Africa later this summer, and instant runoff voting, which would allow voters to vote for second and third choices. While the Green Party's emergence as a national registered party was a joyous occasion for almost all the delegates, this new prominence was not without problems. The Federal Election Commission requires national parties to ratify a platform before the end of August. With over 20 proposals on the agenda, the delegates were forced into votes often before consensus was reached, and much of the platform was left to be finalized by email. Lisa Abel, alternative delegate from Tennessee, discussed how the process could be improved.
It was a very positive experience to be with so many committed Greens from all over the country. Just the fact that we've accepted a structure that's really alien to our values, that of delegate, doesn't mean we should abandon bringing as many of our people with us to these national and state events as we can, so that when there is an attempt at consensus, you can hold an affinity or spokes meeting with your people from your region, get full input and consensus, and then submit that for consensus.
The new Green Party of the United States, green and growing, but not without growing pains. For Radio Volta and Free Speech Radio News, this has been Jamie Graham from Philadelphia.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Radio Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, California, as well as community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Protheb Chatterjee.